Scientific Paradigms and Falsification, Kuhn, Popper, and Problems in Education Research by Emory James Hyslop Markeson. Abstract. By examining the respective contributions of Karl Popper and Thomas Kuhn to the philosophy of science, the author highlights some prevailing problems in this article with the methods of so-called scientific research in education. The author enumerates a number of reasons why such research, in spite of its limited tangible return, continues to gain institutional momentum in colleges and faculties of education. Furthermore, the author argues that the various identified problems, when considered collectively, effectively reduce many claims emerging from scientifically designed education research to the realm of logically invalid hypotheses and questionable circumstantial evidence insulated from academic criticism by various professional and institutional interests. Most educators are generally well aware of the increasing demand from various funding sources and government agencies that education research must adopt what are being described as scientifically based methods. The clarion call for scientific research emerges from agencies such as the National Research Council, NRC, and from the No Child Left Behind, NCLB, legislation in the United States. Indeed, the NCLB Act considers scientific research the sole legitimate means to improve education by supporting only those studies that, quote, employ systematic empirical methods that draw on observation and experiment, and use systematic and objective procedures that promote valid data for generalized classroom application, end quote. In a publication co-sponsored by the NRC, Advancing Scientific Research in Education, the trend towards scientifically based research is described as follows. Quote, the central idea of evidence-based education, that education policy and practice ought to be fashioned based on what is known from rigorous research, offers a compelling way to approach reform efforts. Recent federal trends reflect a growing enthusiasm for such change. Most visibly, the No Child Left Behind Act requires that scientifically-based research drive the use of federal education funds at the state and local levels. In this context, the Center for Education of the National Research Council has undertaken a series of activities to address issues related to the quality of scientific education research. End quote. Although the actual methods of genuine scientific research are never elaborated fully by these agencies beyond identifying very general principles and practices, there is, as reflected in the NCLB legislation, a growing emphasis on scientific research that is empirical, evidence-based, and verifiable. Scientific research in education attempts to explain observable phenomena and apply these explanations as best practice generalizations. By examining the respective contributions of Karl Popper and Thomas Kuhn to the philosophy of science, in this article I will highlight some prevailing problems with the methods of so-called scientific research in education. I will also enumerate a number of reasons why such research, in spite of its limited tangible return, continues to gain institutional momentum in colleges and faculties of education. I will argue that the various identified problems, when considered collectively, effectively reduce many claims emerging from scientifically designed education research to the realm of logically invalid hypotheses and questionable circumstantial evidence insulated from academic criticism by various professional and institutional interests. Although I wish to draw attention to the problem of referring to research in education as scientific, I do not dismiss the possibility of making more limited claims on the basis of empirical investigation. For example, an empirical researcher in education may legitimately claim that phoneme instruction offers an effective approach to reading instruction when employed by a certain type of reader with a certain type of student with specific reading material in a particular context. This form of more limited generalization identifies causal factors that may provide criteria for causal likelihood in a significant number of learning cases. Rather than adopting the notion of scientific research, then, a more pragmatic understanding of research in education is required that appreciates the contextual uniqueness of classroom situations. From this perspective, the results of empirical study are not immutable recipes to follow on the path to some universal culinary perfection, but rather possible ingredients to include in certain dishes in response to certain tastes. One final problem with focusing on empirical research as the primary mechanism to develop educational policy is the diversion it creates from engaging questions about educational purposes. Even if empirical research was able to provide universal strategies for successful teaching and learning, it would be of little ultimate benefit when combined with abject poverty of meaningful educational objectives. All education policy is value-saturated, and more policy discussion ought to grapple with the difficult normative questions of what values are most worth teaching and what type of citizens we are trying to create through public schooling. The claims of scientifically based research. In a brief yet compelling Teachers College Record article, Robert McClintock recently evaluated the contribution of scientific research to instructional practices by reviewing the contents of the American Education Research Association's, AERA, latest Handbook of Research on Teaching, 4th edition. This handbook contains the most updated collection of best practice advice based on empirical research within the field of education. In rather unflattering fashion, he suggests the information contained within the handbook, often conflicting in its multitude of pedagogical edicts, is besmirched by a range of shortcomings that ultimately generate virtually no usable information for teachers, policymakers, and other stakeholders. Quote, "It epitomizes thousands of person years of methodological inquiry, each piece of it fine fare, but in bulk indigestible. It assembles work, pointless in a deep existential sense, for the research goes off in every direction, leaving those in practice, policy, and school administration without a clue what to do. Before them, a research landscape spreads out, a vast plain, with a hillock here and there among the dead and the living. Because educational researchers have proven unable to exercise rigorous control and account for the relevant variables in carefully designed inquiries, their studies have had notoriously conflicting results. If researchers cannot master the variables in controlled settings, why expect practitioners, caught in institutional cross-currents and daily coping with complexity, to be able to rationalize school activities according to the prescripts of research findings?" End quote. The contemporary and ubiquitous perspective that science provides the most appropriate mechanism for the investigation and enrichment of education, then, conveniently ignores the widespread confusion and contradiction that actually pervades the field. As McClintock suggests, the track record of scientific research in education has not proved a particular fruitful pursuit, a position supported by a range of other educators and philosophers. The recently published AERA handbook referred to by McClintock weighs in at 7 pounds and includes just less than 1,300 pages of printed text, citing a wide range of empirical research on teaching and learning. It obviously is a lot of material for even most of the most avid consumer of educational research to digest. With much of the material, as McClintock points out, overtly contradictory in its pedagogical recommendations. There are, of course, numerous and well-documented difficulties with applying scientific principles to explain or understand the complicated dynamics of human behavior, especially as they relate to education. Although these arguments are well rehearsed, it is probably worthwhile to summarize briefly a couple of the most common and salient concerns. One notable observation compares the numerous successes of the natural sciences against those noticeably absent in the human sciences. Indeed, no overarching or explanatory theories of learning have ever achieved the scientific status of general relativity or Darwinian evolution. Egan elucidated this difficulty for the social sciences, specifically as it relates to educational psychology. Psychology, for all the talk of science and scientific research in education, is not a science like physics or biology. And education is unlike engineering in that education is value-saturated in ways that engineering is not. Medicine can provide the doctor with a largely unproblematic aim for intervention. Such a relatively clear aim does not exist in the conceptual ferment of education, where radically different ends and purposes are vividly contested. End quote. As Egan correctly observes, the goals in education are inevitably normative and are, therefore, the consequence of philosophical debate and related value judgments rather than empirical verification. Other critics, such as Gold, maintained that all of the pseudoscientific attempts to explain and classify human behavior have ultimately failed due to the sheer complexity of human experience and interaction. Max Weber, perhaps the most influential social scientist in history, argued that social science as an objective field of inquiry is impossible unless a clear distinction is consistently drawn between empirical claims and any subsequent evaluation of those claims. The social scientist carefully distinguishes between impartial observation or the reporting of phenomena and any interpretation of observations and data. More simply put, according to Weber, science demarcates between empirical data, or propositional facts, and statements related to value judgments. Quote, "What is important from the methodological point of view is that the validity of a practical imperative as a norm, on the one hand, and truth claims of a statement of empirical fact, on the other, create problems at totally different levels, and the value of each of them will be diminished if this is not recognized and if the attempt is made to force them into the same category." End quote. The NCLB conviction that standardized testing affords an empirical and scientific method to measure the quality of public schools and teacher quality illustrates Weber's point. Those promoting such assessment practices assume that high test scores on narrowly designed standardized tests equate with quality education and teaching, whereas low scores supposedly indicate school failure and teacher incompetence. For example, the NCLB Act clearly states, quote, "The data will be available in annual report cards on school performance and on statewide progress. They will give parents information about the quality of their children's schools and the qualifications of their teachers," end quote. However, any inferences emerging from this type of empirical research are not scientific, intersubjective, or for the most part, educationally productive. They are based instead on an apparent mix of empirical facts and conceptual confusion, where quality is simply assumed to equate with narrow, normative assumptions about what constitutes educational excellence. One widely accepted practice within social science research, and one openly advocated in the discourse on scientific research and education, as illustrated by the NCLB narrative, involves empirical verification. For example, the evidence or data collected on teaching and learning are considered scientific by education researchers when they can be empirically verified and supposedly generalized beyond the observed group. The preoccupation with verification as the standard for acceptable scientific research and education emerges at least in part from positivist epistemology. More specifically, verificationism, a system of thought where a statement is considered meaningful if and only if it is empirically verifiable. One specific objective of positivism and its progeny, verificationism, was the complete elimination of metaphysics, including all ethical, religious, and aesthetic claims, from philosophical discourse. In Language, Truth, and Logic, A.J. Ayer, one of the movement's most vocal and renowned proponents, employed the empirical epistemological assumptions of verificationism to eliminate all metaphysical claims from the category of meaningful statements. Quote, "The criterion which we use to test the genuineness of apparent statements of fact is the criterion of verifiability. We say that a sentence is factually significant to any given person if and only if he knows how to verify the proposition it purports to express. That is, if he knows what observations would lead him, under certain conditions, to accept the proposition as being true or reject it as being false." End quote. In a scientifically based culture, the ideas associated with verificationism actually seem quite tenable, and Ayer's position does raise certain epistemological challenges against metaphysical claims. But as Karl Popper illustrates, grave logical and epistemic problems remain with verificationism when the approach is adopted as a scientific method that affords the possibility of universal instantiations. Karl Popper and the theory of falsification. Karl Popper dismissed the radical application of empiricism adopted by verificationists because, as a rudimentary epistemological point, no unmediated ontological claims about the world, empirical or otherwise, are theoretically possible. All epistemic stances are mediated because they are unavoidably grounded in certain non-empirically verifiable assumptions, and their corresponding claims about the structure of experience remain open to dispute. Empiricism, then, as the foundation for verificationism and scientific research and education, shares this mediated quality. The verificationists eventually admitted this problem when they confessed that the verification principle, that is, the statement that only empirically verifiable statements are meaningful, could not be empirically verified, and therefore failed, based on their own criteria, to qualify as a proposition. Although Popper understood the epistemic limitations of verificationism as a scientific method, he did not deny the important contribution of empiricism to scientific inquiry. Observation and induction, as Bacon recognized in the 17th century when he overthrew the epistemic tyranny of Aristotelian deductive logic and the metaphysical absurdities it allegedly proved, are justified central components of science. However, when applied in isolation from other practices, these new instruments are potentially misleading and therefore inadequate to protect the integrity of scientific claims. Popper argues that theories, hypotheses, and conjectures based on verification never produce universally true propositions, and hence universal claims, regardless of the number of times they are corroborated by individual instances of empirical confirmation, are always logically false. Within formal logic, there are, of course, several important restrictions regarding universal generalizations, with the intention of preventing the extension of claims based on true assertions about some individuals having a given property, limited observations, to a logically false universal claim about all individuals having that same property. A classic example of this error in education is evident in the various claims advanced by Piaget on human stage development, claims initially based on an extraordinarily limited number of actual and contextualized observations. As a result of recognizing the potential folly, both logical and scientific, of such verification practices, Popper developed a superior logical model to distinguish scientific claims from dubious generalizations inferred from a limited number of observed cases. Popper correctly recognizes it is notoriously simple when collecting data to obtain confirmations, or verifications, of particular hypotheses when researchers actively seek out such findings. For example, if dedicated Piagetians wish to discover cases confirming the theory of stage development, they will undoubtedly find and report many such instances, perhaps even most instances, where the theory's predictions hold true. Similarly, if we are proponents of collaborative learning as a best practice in mathematics, we will inevitably identify numerous cases where the strategy seemingly does enrich student learning in the subject. But in Popper's view, the claims emerging from such observations afford little more than circumstantial evidence and do not qualify as scientific in any meaningful sense of the term. According to falsification, the actual litmus test for a meaningful scientific theory is not the number of cases empirically verified, but rather a theory's ability to prohibit certain things from occurring contrary to its postulates. In other words, the more a particular theory forbids, the more scientific the theory. Alternatively, and most if not all of the so-called scientific research in education seemingly falls into this latter category, a theory that forbids virtually nothing is demonstrably non-scientific. Obviously, the vast majority of claims emerging from education research claiming to be scientific are in fact based on the faulty logic of verificationism rather than on falsificationism. This, of course, reduces the vast majority of claims about teaching and learning, such as those contained in the AERA's Handbook on Research on Teaching, to the category of logically false universal instantiations, and correspondingly removes them from the realm of legitimate scientific theories. The application of verificationism and induction as the paradigmatic approach to education also explains the significant number of contradictory claims McClintock reports in his analysis cited above. Popper recognizes that some genuinely testable theories, such as stage development learning, when demonstrated unscientific through falsification, will be rescued by their proponents through ad hoc claims that attempt to explain away the identified anomalies. But this practice comes with a significant cost, because although such explanations are always possible, according to Popper, they rescue the theory in question from complete refutation only at the cost of destroying its scientific status and credibility. Unlike verificationism, the prevailing method of evidence-based and scientific research in education, falsificationism is based not only in observation, empiricism, but also on the basic rules of formal logic. Indeed, the falsification of theoretical postulates and their scientific implications is derived from the elementary modus tollens form of deductive logic. This very basic rule of formal logic actually provides the entire foundation for Popper's theory of falsification. Popper's theory, therefore, moves science beyond the mere pursuit of observation and induction, the latter central to the practice of generalization, initially championed by Bacon. Stated as a simple, conditional statement, then, falsification works as follows. Quote, if it is raining, I take my umbrella. I am not taking my umbrella, therefore it is not raining. End quote. Within the context of classroom practice, falsification might occur when a teacher employs a specific pedagogical strategy based on a theoretical postulate that predicts a specific learning outcome. If the learning outcome fails to follow from the strategy when accurately applied, the teacher can assume the theory is false. Unlike falsification, the faulty logic of verificationism practiced in the vast majority of empirical and evidence-based research in education commits the notorious formal fallacy of affirming the consequent, where T is greater than P, follows from the empirical verification of P and the subsequent inference of T. For example, translated into narrative form, the formula correlates with the following claim. Arthur performs well on critical thinking tests, P, after taking Cheryl's course in critical thinking, T. Therefore, we fallaciously conclude that Cheryl must be a fabulous teacher of critical thinking. Of course, the obvious logical problem within such logically fallacious claims, in addition to committing the ergo hoc post propter hoc informal fallacy, is that there could be a multitude of other reasons that cause Arthur to perform well on a critical thinking test, such as his general level of academic intelligence or his pre-existing content knowledge and understanding related to the test questions. If we return to the example from the previous paragraph, affirming the consequent wrongly concludes that because I'm taking my umbrella, it must be raining when there could be any number of reasons I decide to take along the protective device, such as a forecast of rain later in the day. Following Popper, the critically important point is that although verificationism is the universal approach within educational research, it commits an elementary logical error that renders its subsequent claims both fallacious and unscientific. Popper's theory of falsification allows this problem because his mode of inference, that is, the application of modus tollens, falsifies the entire system, the proposed theory as well as the initial conditions, required for the deduction of the statement P, that is, the falsified statement. When P, the observed component, is falsified, T, the theoretical component, is falsified as well. The crux of Popper's philosophy of science is that although no theory can be confirmed empirically as absolutely and universally true, a theory can be falsified if one of its hypotheses can be demonstrated as false. One attempt to overturn falsification is Bayesian confirmation theory, a probability theory formulated in the early 19th century by Reverend Thomas Bayes. If confirmation theory is accepted without qualification, it seemingly escapes the logical fallacies of verificationism by offering a hypothetical deductive truth. However, Bayesian confirmation theory both supports and limits verificationism because Bayes' theorem demonstrates that conclusive confirmation is only possible under specific experimental circumstances. Quote, suppose that I am still testing the hypothesis that I have an all-black bag of marbles. I am convinced that the bag is either all black or else 20% black. The bag contains 500 marbles, and I have already drawn out 100 black marbles. I draw one more marble out and discover that it too is black. In this case, according to my background information, the bag is either all black or 20% black, and if it is 20% black, it cannot have 101 black marbles. So no matter how low my prior probability for the theory was, I end up with a posterior probability of 1. This is precisely the conclusive confirmation that Popper denies. End quote. However, there are obvious limitations with the type of confirmation possible when applying Bayesian reasoning to research and education, because the number of marbles contained in Brown's example involves a known and finite quantity. Although a hypothesis may be conclusively empirically verified in this particular instance when the variables are limited and known, the employed example cannot be extended to substantiate universal generalizations in education. For example, we cannot universally claim that all students will benefit academically from small class sizes or early literacy instruction because the quantity and type of students involved is unknown, and these variables are constantly changing in taxonomic composition. Purported scientific theories within education, such as Piaget's or the multitude of claims regarding best practice, are in fact easily falsifiable. Recall, for example, the prevalent contradictions McClintock cites in his critique of the AAR handbook. There are many well-documented instances where the claims of Piaget's theory of stage development simply do not hold, or instances where so-called best teaching practices do not result in enhanced student achievement. Although Piaget's theory of stage development and claims of best practice are easily falsified, they are insulated from complete refutation within education by the addition of various ad hoc explanations that attempt to salvage from them the epistemic scrap heap. As Popper points out, these ad hoc principles, such as some students in Piagetian studies are between stages, achieve this objective only at the cost of destroying the scientific credibility of the theory. The various theories that emerge from educational research are almost uniformly based on the faulty logic of verificationism. In other words, researchers focus on instances where the predictions of theoretical claims based on certain hypotheses hold true, and they want to generalize from these particular observed instances to an entire population. As I have pointed out, pursuing this practice commits the logical fallacy of affirming the consequent and reduces scientific claims to examples of faulty logic, invalid universal instantiations, and circumstantial evidence. Kuhn and the Structure of Scientific Paradigms. The analysis offered by Thomas Kuhn in his seminal work, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, shed some important additional light on why this type of faulty logic and flawed science continues to dominate education research and scholarship with very little sustained resistance or criticism. Kuhn suggests that monumental efforts are often undertaken by researchers to protect theories from falsification and ensure the longevity of questionable hypotheses even when numerous countercases significantly undermine the theory in question. Quote, in the course of any spell of normal science, anomalies accumulate, problems and difficulties which only arise because of the attempt to fit nature into the pattern described by the existing orthodoxy. When the extent of the anomaly gives rise to widespread unease and dissatisfaction within the existing framework of research, a period of crisis begins in which work becomes more speculative and loosely structured. Eventually, practice rearranges itself around new procedures and new concepts which are thought to deal more adequately with the anomalies of the old scheme of things. A scientific revolution occurs and creates a new basis for a sequence of normal science. End quote. Although there are similarities between the natural and human sciences according to Kuhn's analysis, there are also some important differences. First, the dynamics of human behavior and the agency driving that behavior, as I alluded to earlier in the article, ensure theoretical anomalies are far more common and deeper in scope within education research compared to research conducted in the natural sciences. For example, we might not only legitimately question the generalizability of a given human action, but also the consistency of action within a single individual from time T1 to T2. Second, although natural science occasionally reaches a crisis point where an existing theory is incommensurable with other accumulated knowledge in the field, educational research seems virtually immune to such paradigmatic shifts because conflicting findings are seemingly viewed as relatively unproblematic. Again, consider the recently published AARA handbook as a case in point. As Kieran Egan correctly pointed out in Getting It Wrong from the Beginning, Our Progressivist Inheritance from Herbert Spencer, John Dewey, and Jean Piaget, ideas that were highly problematic 150 years ago and based on faulty scientific assumptions continue to dominate the discourse surrounding contemporary educational practice. There are, for the most part it seems, no effective mechanisms for jettisoning faulty hypotheses in education research and practice. Kuhn offers some exceptionally plausible insights into why researchers in education, largely undaunted by their pseudoscientific practices and plethora of contradictory claims, continue to pursue faulty scientific practices related to their work. Most of the research that takes place within social science, and this observation is especially true in educational research, involves convergent thinking. Convergent thinking entails a sweeping, often unquestioned acceptance of an existing theory and the corresponding attempt to make sure one's research fits into that prevailing hypothesis, both in terms of its conceptual framework as well as its observed outcomes. Within education, this type of thinking is reflected in the numerous slogans disguised as practices that dominate the field. Kuhn describes the problem as follows. Quote, "We have attempted to teach students how to arrive at correct answers that our civilization has taught us as correct." End quote. He actually singles out the social sciences in particular for discouraging and rejecting divergent thinking, or thinking that challenges preconceived notions about the necessary appropriateness of prevailing theoretical frameworks. There are other pressures on researchers in education to ensure their work conforms to pre-existing patterns of thought and practice. The various textbooks in educational psychology and research courses, for example, typically support theoretical assumptions and discourses about education in an entirely uncritical manner. An educational psychology textbook exploring the subject of developmental learning may cite a number of experiments or researchers that generally confirm Piaget's notion of stage development. Decisive criticisms of the theory are seldom entertained, but even when they are included, they are portrayed as easily explained and exceptionally rare anomalies. New textbooks are written and published, new lessons taught, and new theory proponents created. Then, all in the virtual absence of reflection on the actual tenability of much of the theoretical material. The somewhat troubling message this sends, according to Kuhn, is that scientific truth is far less important than professional expediency. Quote, "Reports of effective research repeatedly imply that all but the most striking and central discrepancies could be taken care of by the existing theory if only there were time to take them on. The men who make these reports find most discrepancies trivial or uninteresting, an evaluation that they can ordinarily base upon their faith in the current theory. Without that faith, their work would be wasteful of our time and talent." End quote. There are a number of reasons why educational researchers are reluctant to jettison a particular theory, even when they are aware of the evidence against it. These reasons include the institutional and collegial pressure on academic researchers to adopt the precepts of an existing theory or risk marginalization within the field in question. The politics of research suggests that some perspectives inevitably gain far more return in the form of research funding, publications, and eventual professional prestige than others. Also, investigating the anomalies or conceptual problems embedded in a particular educational theory may divert a researcher's attention from completing a successful research agenda. For example, in the area of critical thinking, someone who has spent an entire career developing strategies committed to a highly problematic process model is likely to become defensive when it is suggested that the field of critical thinking is conceptually and epistemologically flawed beyond redemption. Although rejecting the entire discourse surrounding critical thinking may be the most epistemologically honest and pedagogically appropriate action to pursue, it is a politically unpopular one, given the various vested academic and research interests in the field. Within educational psychology in particular, researchers go to extraordinary lengths to salvage their concepts and theories from complete disrepute. This intergenerational perpetuation of faulty science is nicely conveyed by Barnes in his summary of Kuhn's position. Quote, "According to Kuhn, if one looks at the extended training which precedes research in a developed scientific field, then its most evident distinctive feature is the extent to which it relies upon textbooks. The accepted terminology of a field, its methods, its findings, and its favored modes of perception are all conveyed through their use. And the credibility of all these components of scientific culture depends not upon the indications of experience lying behind the exposition of the text, but upon the authority of the teacher and the institutional apparatus which supports it." End quote. In essence, what occurs within any particular field is a systematic indoctrination of future researchers into the theories, methods, and beliefs that dominate a particular area of inquiry. This problem appears even more salient in education than within the natural sciences, since the method by which problematic theories are jettisoned, that is, falsification, is virtually ignored by the entire discipline, and faulty claims under the guise of genuine scientific theory unfortunately enjoy a very protracted and plutonium-like half-life. A way forward for research and education. Although research in education is unable to meet the standard of a scientific claim, it does not follow that empirical study in the field is entirely worthless. Much of the research in education is actually quite fascinating, and important and exciting new discoveries about teaching and learning may very well emerge from work in fields such as neuroscience. Rather, policy documents that outline research protocols must simply adopt a more modest expectation on the outcomes empirically based research in education can realistically achieve. The search for universal silver bullets that serve the needs of all teachers and learners is a misguided one, and understanding that natural science practices apply to research and education will not deliver such outcomes is an important first step in changing policy and practice direction. In addition to moderating the expectations of empirical research in education, it is important for policy developers, funding agencies, and other stakeholders to support areas of inquiry and scholarship beyond scientifically based practices. Egan convincingly argued that the real problem in education is not the lack of an adequate research base, but a poverty in conceptions of education. He describes the problem as follows. Quote, "Much current educational research, viewed from this new paradigm, looks like an avoidance activity. It is looking under the psychological lamppost where it is easier to see things, rather than engaging in the harder task of generating educational theories that provide the light that can guide practice. It is easier and more attractive to engage in technical work under an accepted paradigm than to do hard thinking about the value-saturated idea of education." End quote. Previous to the current dominant paradigm of scientifically based research in education, scholars often developed ideas that promoted interesting and innovative learning experiences for students. One such example of an idea was Neil Postman's Spaceship Earth. This particular conception of education appreciates how, as Dewey suggested, the means and ends of education are intrinsically connected in the absence of any corresponding empirical verification. Postman argued that the Spaceship Earth narrative in education would encourage global consciousness, interdependence, and cooperation among human beings as stewards or caretakers of the planet we all inhabit. The teaching of archaeology, anthropology, and astronomy are all incorporated directly into the Spaceship Earth theme. Postman suggested archaeology instills, quote, "an analysis of the preciousness of Earth, as well as some sense of the continuity of humanity's sojourn on Earth," end quote. Anthropology provides students with, quote, "an awe-inspiring sense of humanity's range of difference, as well as a sense of our common points," end quote. And instruction in astronomy raises, quote, "fundamental questions about ourselves and our mission and cultivates a sense of awe, interdependence, and global responsibility," end quote. One immediate concern likely to be raised by empirical research advocates is how we can be sure these subjects and themes will achieve the objectives Postman identifies, because without such empirical research, the claims are tantamount to speculation. An analysis of social science research published by Jan Smedlund highlighted the pointless pursuit of empirical verification in such situations. He analyzed a range of social science research in the article, Between the Analytic and the Arbitrary, a Case Study of Psychological Research, arguing that the empirical generalizations emerging from social science research merely explicate the analytic relationship between ordinary language concepts. Quote, "The theoretical analysis contains elements of both the analytic and the arbitrary, but neither is overtly acknowledged. The analytic is incompatible with the aspiration to empirical testing, and the arbitrary element is incompatible with the aspiration to generality and timelessness. These latent contradictions can remain generally undiscovered only as long as the standards for theoretical precision remain at their current low level. Meanwhile, the facade of scientific respectability is only maintained by the advanced technology for data gathering and analysis," end quote. Even before Smedlund's critique, A.R. Lauch challenged Edward Thorndike's empirically established law of effect on similar grounds by suggesting the relationship between repeated behaviors and pleasurable consequences is conceptually linked. Testing the empirical veracity of Postman's ideas would then, quote, "on a much more complex level, be like trying to establish that all bachelors in Vancouver are unmarried," end quote. As curriculum developers and policymakers, we also need to spend far more time in educational research and scholarship determining our destination rather than identifying the best available vehicle to take us there. The hegemonic focus on scientifically based research as the prevailing paradigm in faculties of education has unfortunately reduced this most important of all questions about education to the very margins of academic discourse. Dialogue on this topic is especially critical during a historical era when a market model of educational reform focused on human capital objectives potentially undermines the structures and principles of educational objectives, consistent with protecting the aims of schooling in a democratic society. Conclusion. In this article, I have identified some central problems with so-called scientific research in education. The theory of falsification developed by Popper affords a powerful logical mechanism that reduces many theories in education based on limited numbers of observed cases to little more than faulty generalizations. As Kuhn convincingly argues in his analysis of scientific paradigms, the institutional and research commitment to prevailing theories, dominant research methods, and corresponding agendas lend a powerful incentive to insulate existing hypotheses in education from compelling critiques via falsification that would interfere with the production of multiple edition education textbooks, threaten the procurement of research grants from agencies increasingly sympathetic to scientific research, and potentially undermine the focus and chronological progress of numerous academic careers. These various pressures combine to train, or perhaps more accurately indoctrinate, continuing generations of education researchers to accept passively the tenets of a prevailing hypothesis, rather than question or reject them based on numerous observed cases where the related predictions do not hold. It is small wonder, then, that McClintock concludes his condemnation of education research by suggesting the emphasis on scientific research is actually doing the field of future education and related policy development more harm than good. Quote, school improvement requires quotidian labor, many persons thinking hard on their feet, responding to an endless flux of concrete situations with knowledge, care, and insight. The myth that fixing the schools somehow depends on the magic of educational researchers deflects attention, material support, and respect from those charged with the real tasks of keeping school, diminishing their morale and confidence. End quote. I will not advance the absolutist claim that all empirical research in education is a waste of available time and resources. However, we must collectively ask ourselves as academics and policymakers whether the research outcomes we achieve warrant the extraordinary resources invested in the exercise. In both education policy and practice, we must also begin re-asking the difficult normative questions about appropriate educational ends and where schools, as institutions of learning, ought to be leading students as future democratic citizens to create the society we desire. This is not an empirical question, but a decidedly normative one. And hence, determining appropriate educational ends is really the primary education policy concern.